Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. This is Miriam Gillian for the Gist of Freedom. We are here today to discuss with our guest today. Her name is Kimberly Simmons, and Ms. Simmons is here today to talk about something, the anniversary of which we're about to experience out of Detroit, Michigan. Kimberly is a survivor or a witness to the Detroit riots that happened in 1967, in a year and a time when riots were happening across the United States in black communities. So as soon as Kimberly comes and joins us, we'll be able to have that
I'm here.
Oh, greetings. I'm so sorry.
No, I was listening to
anything. It's so quiet on the line. Beautiful.
I was listening to your wonderful introduction.
Oh, well, welcome. Thank you. Okay. So let's get started, Kimberly. It's such a pleasure to speak with you today. I was privy to this information that you're about to share just through what you posted. I had not, prior to this conversation, really heard too much about the Detroit riots, although I do understand it was one of the largest riots in the country. So is that true?
That's true, and before we go much further, I will say that I prefer, or I shouldn't say I prefer, but most of those of us that were, or our survivors, if you would like to as you have so generously put it, but those of us that were part of the experience, we tend to use the word rebellion rather than riot.
Rebellion. Okay.
And
and so if you'd introduce yourself, we'll pick it up from there. Basically, however you'd like to introduce yourself. And we will use that word.
How to introduce who I am and what I do. I just read online Leslie Gist, the wonderful, wonderful leader of this podcast. I just saw her in-depth background on who I am and my family, but I am a historian. I am a Detroit-born historian. I believe that having been part of a family that's been in a place for just about 185 years and with a lot of background on the place that we have chosen to stay, I think that gives me kind of a unique outlook on what Detroit is going to experience over the next week. I am descended from a family that sought freedom 185 years ago by using the network known as the Underground Railroad. I am also the descended daughter of a family that was a Revolutionary War family. And I'm also the descended daughter of the Mayflower. So when freedom is interjected into my calling card, I guess I have a lot to talk about. Probably what I am most conscious about is giving a lot of or sharing a lot of the family history and the family knowledge of what freedom means, in particular as it ties to what's coming upon us the next in the next week or so regarding the Detroit Rebellion of 1967 is what I'm looking forward to today.
Now, Kimberly, can you, before you continue, first of all, let me just say that's quite an impressive resume in terms of pedigree. But I'd also like for you to just, before we delve into the history of it, can you just share with our listeners exactly what's happening in the next week in Detroit?
Well, sure. As a author, we were gratefully published by Wayne State University Press last year. Our book is entitled A Fluid Frontier. It's a collaborative effort between Canadians and Americans, six Canadian and six American authors. And we recently received, after a year, another review of our book. And the book is actually draws upon the experience of Underground Railroad freedom seekers, but it was reviewed here in Detroit by Riverwise, which is out of the Grace Boggs Center, to draw the parallels between a freedom that was sought almost 200 years ago versus the freedom that was fought on or fought over in the streets of Detroit in 1967. 67 brought about a group of rebellions across the country that involved minorities, in particular the African-American community, and we'll just say the powers that be. In Detroit, it was no different. However, it was the largest. It started on July the 23rd, and it lasted for 5 days, at which point the National Guard was actually activated by the President of the United States. And
that would be Lyndon
Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And after 5 days of a diverse crowd that was involved, we ended with a neighborhood that was predominantly African American, very densely populated, and quite the active neighborhood. It was, I guess you would call, from the African American standpoint, the center of town. We ended up with 43 dead, injuries, arrest, and a neighborhood that was basically torn to shambles and burned down. We call it a rebellion because we have historians and sociologists have decided that when you use the term riot, that brings to mind a violent conflict, and it generally speaking, when you're talking in terms of the African-American community, that's when the term is used, rather than a rebellion that brings to mind forces, if you want to say the populace, rebelling against a bad system. And those two words go a long way between making a difference. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that later. The 67 rebellion started
I'm sorry, not to cut you, but I just was curious. You'd mentioned that is there something happening before we go right there, and we're going to go through a whole lot of conversation about this, but you mentioned something happening next week as a result of the riot. So I just wanted to kind of put that as a note. They're having commemoration, is that right?
Yeah, there's commemoration starting on, well, actually, I guess you would say the commemoration began the first of the year.
Okay.
But it's culminating because the actual event, the events of 67 that have stirred up all of this quite a bit of commemorative happenings actually started on July the 23rd, which is Sunday, so it'll be exactly 50 days. 50 years
okay.
from the time in 1967, but there's been a lot of lead up to this, and as a matter of fact, there's been quite a bit that is coming out of this incident because there's actually a Hollywood movie production that is debuting on the red carpet here in Detroit on the 25th. That's been done by a Oscar-winning. She was the first Oscar-winning woman to direct a movie, and she directed a movie called Detroit. And it's actually about a piece of the incident of those 5 days.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. So, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I just wanted to get that because some of our listeners may fade away and they may want to know or find out more. So you were saying that in terms of rebellion, and so you were speaking about the term rebellion and how rebellion versus riots. So we can pick up from there.
Well, perhaps let me just kind of, for those that are listening that don't know anything about what happened here in Detroit in 1967, let me just kind of give a brief overview. It's a historical fact. It's not hard to look it up, but maybe just to kind of give a broad idea of what happened here on July the 23rd, 1967. To be exact, there was what is termed in the community, a blind pig, which is an after-hours bar that was well-known in the community. It was located on 12th, what is known as 12th Street here in Detroit. To be exact, 9125 12th Street at the corner of Claremont Street. And that was smack dab in the middle of a neighborhood, vibrant, as I said, the center of the black community here and very densely populated from people that had actually been displaced from another part of the community that was the heart, what was known then as Hastings Street, and had been displaced because of a freeway and, urban development or redevelopment. So the population that included a lot of great migration families, returning war veterans, had been displaced and moved to this neighborhood that was surrounded 12th and Claremont, and it became another center of the black community here in Detroit. And this particular blind pig or after-hours place was well-known to not only just the community members, it was known to the police. And this is not something that is unknown to other communities across the country. It happens all the time. It's not like we don't know this. And what happened that particular night is there was someone was returning from the war, because Vietnam was going on at the time, if we recall, and there was a celebration. And it had gone on into the middle of the night. And the police decided they were going to raid. And, you know, sometimes the police don't. They turn their – and we're not questioning right or wrong, but sometimes they turn their heads to what would be an after-hours place. But this particular evening, they decided they were going to raid. Now, our police force at the time – was 95% or so white. The population of Detroit was quite the opposite. The population
like
in Detroit.
40%?
White.
40%
yes.
Black or something like that, right?
No, it was it was actually 40% white.
Oh, okay.
That's
correct. That's incorrect, yes. Uh-huh.
It was the opposite. And, okay, so you have a police force that's white and you have a community that's black. So there you have it. It was a recipe for disaster. And disaster is what happened on July the 23rd. It was a... a catastrophe in the making. There had been, as you look around, the parallels are still the same across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Police brutality, unnecessary use of force. I could go on. The parallels to what's going on today is almost scary, actually. But on a hot summer night on the 23rd of July, 1967, in Detroit, Michigan, it was a recipe for rebellion to start. There had been previously the year before, in 1966, a smaller skirmish that had happened, oh, maybe 20 minutes away on the other side of town, on our east side. The July 23rd event was west side. But basically, it was, again, the skirmish between the police and, we'll just say, pedestrians. By the 23rd at 4 o'clock in the morning, after a bottle was thrown into the arresting crowd, as people would say, hell broke loose, and it went on for 5 days. It's not a pretty remembrance, but I would have to make sure that everyone understands it was not a riot. I have heard descriptions over the last couple months that this was a race riot. It was not. There have been race riots in the city of Detroit, and I'm sure in other places. This was not. This was a rebellion, and it was the haves versus the have-nots. There were businesses that were owned by members of our Jewish community in the area. There were members of the, white community that lived in the area. It was a predominantly black, but there was still a mix of whites that were still in the neighborhood. And so when the rebellion started, everyone was involved. It wasn't like it was the white versus the blacks. It was more like the neighborhood versus the police. So it turned into something. It was not a race riot, and I try very hard, and many of the historians here have been trying very hard to make sure that we don't term it as such, because that is not what it was.
Okay. Can I ask you a question before you go on? I did some quick research, and I realized that this term riot versus rebellion, and I don't want us to dwell too much on that, but I do want to have a clarification. In your mind, what's the difference between a rebellion? You sort of explained that, but what's the difference of race riot? What is a race riot considered?
Well, race riot, to me, or to most, I would say, because I've had this conversation with sociologists and social workers, when you say a race riot means there's a fight or a altercation between two races. Usually in the United States, unfortunately, because of our history, generally speaking, we're talking about white versus black. In this particular case, this wasn't a white versus black issue. This was the haves, and rather than say haves, this was the police and the powers that be versus those that didn't or perceived themselves to not have the power and were tired of getting pushed around. And that included not only blacks, though it was mostly an African-American experience, there were also whites involved as well.
Okay.
There was looting. Businesses, homes were burned to the ground in the neighborhood. And the looting included not just the black population. There were whites involved, too. So that's the difference. When you talk about a race riot, you're talking about the fight between, as I said, the minority population, generally speaking, versus the majority. But that was not what 67 in Detroit was all about. It was not.
Mm-hmm.
It was a population that had enough.
Right. And so I just wanted that clarification because, you know, it's so difficult. It's 50 years. And so many things have changed and many things have not changed in terms of either the lexicon, the understanding, or community. So I just wanted to establish that what exactly you're saying. So you were a witness to this rebellion at the time. Where were you?
Well, when you know, you want to say everybody in Detroit was a witness. If you lived here, if your family lived here, in my case, my family had been here a century, you were a witness. I was, at the time, I was almost seven years old.
Mm-hmm.
My father and my mother actually rented a upper flat of a home that was owned by my grandparents. And we lived on what was called Blaine Street. It still is. Very little there, unfortunately, right now. But we lived between Byron and Woodrow Wilson, which means nothing to you. But the epicenter was one block, and I do mean one block away.
Mm-hmm.
Our family had literally moved away to the west, further west, about a year before the riot happened, riot rebellion. And my grandparents were left in their flat. My grandmother was shipped to our house, and my father, my uncle, my grandfather sat watch over the flat, like many did over that neighborhood, watching over the property.
This is during the rebellion? This is what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am. Great. So witnessing, when you're a child of seven and you're sitting on your front porch on a lovely summer Sunday afternoon and you're playing jacks with your next-door neighbor, who's Jewish, and your best friend, and the two of you play jacks. The kids don't play jacks anymore, but anyway, playing jacks enjoying summer afternoon, and you happen to look up, and you see what looks like to you G.I. Joe on a tank that your little brother plays with submachine guns pointed at you, driving down in front of your front door. I would say that you are a witness.
Mm-hmm.
I have a memory, and I'm 50 years down the road now, of seeing G.I. Joe with a machine gun pointed in my face. I should say the face of myself and the face of my best girlfriend. That's hard to explain to a 7-year-old. It's hard to explain to a 70-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But in this world, unfortunately, things like that still happen. Not just in this country, but it happens in other countries. I often think of that when that memory, because as 23rd of July gets closer, I think of all the things, the smell of the burning, people being moved around on TV. I think of the young people that live in the Middle East that are involved in all of this warfare, and you come to realize that they're going to remember that all their life. That is not ever something that is going to go away. It'll be part of their makeup of who they are. There's a lot of anger comes out of it, fear, and I would say that I've got a lot of that anger, not just myself, but as well as other people that experience the same kind of memories as I did of that particular.
Well, it's a severe trauma. You went through severe trauma, as did the entire neighborhood, and I'm sure the greater Detroit.
Well, that's the reason why we are commemorating this moment, because if you were to ask some of the old time Detroiters about that moment in time, that moment in Detroit's history, they will tell you, and as I say to you, that we kind of got frozen in that moment. Detroit at that time in 1967, this city is a civil rights town. That is why I'm here. The Underground Railroad, the end of the road, was here. My family, after arriving here at the earliest in 1833, never left the region. On both sides of our Detroit River, we live on both sides, my family does. And from the original civil rights movement, which is the Underground Railroad, to what most people consider the modern-day civil rights movement, which was during the 60s, the atmosphere in Detroit has always been about activism and freedom. But that July 23rd, 1967 date almost froze who we are as a group, as a people here. We are still trying to fight that battle. That battle in Detroit is still being fought. It's being fought in many different ways, but that particular moment in time, it's like the city has never really gotten over it. And it's very hard to describe to someone that doesn't live here or maybe hasn't lived here for a long time. Hence, that's why we have a lot of cities going through quite a gentrification movement right now. And we've got a lot of younger people, millennials, and younger members of the Generation X generation, and they use the terms riot, race riot, black and white. They use those terms because they don't understand the place they live. And
can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
When you say you're frozen in time, can you explain what that means? When you say the entire city hadn't gotten over it, I mean, I can understand the personal trauma and shock. So how has that affected maybe daily life, interpersonal communication or relationships? How has it affected jobs and growth? And how has that affected you when you say you were frozen in time, or the city was in 1967?
You know, this city was at the time. It didn't happen afterwards, but at the time, it was already going through what is termed a lot of people make statements, white flight. This city was losing its white population. But that fleeing to the suburbs that we look at as happening in the 60s and the 70s, actually in Detroit, had already started. And it escalated. 1967 basically escalated it.
So question, if white flight was going on, was it just because, I mean, you mentioned that that was the end stop for the Underground Railroad, so they were used to having blacks, I suppose, everywhere in Detroit, or even in sort of segregated parts of town. What was sponsoring the white flight? In other words, why this sudden movement in white flight? Why, if they're used to having blacks in the town of Detroit?
Detroit is still considered, I read a survey or not too long ago, Detroit is the Detroit region, the metropolitan region, which is very large, is still considered the most segregated place in America.
Okay.
So to say that we are used to one another, we may be used to one another, but we don't live with each other.
Okay.
This is that, and 1967, July of 1967, really, how can I say that, exaggerated the differences.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it was such a big deal that our police force was not integrated.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if the majority was, well, it basically it was, the majority was policing the minority.
That was probably true throughout major cities and throughout America, isn't that so?
It was early civil rights movement, so yes, I would say so. However, let's consider the kind of town that Detroit is or was. Detroit was the home of the Great Migration. Remember, Mr. Ford sent out a flyer and said he was willing to pay $5 a day for those people in the South that were trying to find a better way out of perhaps sharecropping or living in small towns and in the rural South to find a better way and get economic freedom. So you had a town full of former Southerners, a lot of, you had a town full of former warriors that had been in World War I, Korea, some who had already returned from Vietnam. Most of them in this town, black. The heroes known as the Tuskegee Airmen, that corps was actually stationed here in Detroit at a Air Force base known as Selfridge. Mm-hmm. You had a core group of who are now Congressional Medal of Honor winners. You also had those that were working that had come up and started to work in the auto industry after that call by Mr. Ford. You had a group of citizens that literally were the core or the driving force behind what was Detroit's and still is Detroit's industry, and that's the auto industry. So you're talking about a group of people, mostly African American, who were driving the economy here.
Yes.
Excuse me, driving the economy. And surrounded by those that, yes, the whites were in charge. We had a white mayor, white council, city council, governor white, secretary of state. I could go on. We had recently, there was a new district created for the United States House of Representatives and had recently created it, and the man that took a seat and has been in that seat since he sat down, and that's John Conyers. But he was the first black U.S. representative from this area, Congressman Conyers. Bless him. He's now the dean of Congress. But you have you've had a recipe for basically what happened. You had the people driving the economy were the minority, and the majority were those that were running
right.
out. Okay, so to
so
say that everybody. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, in your opinion, so the it sounds like it was a recipe for disaster based on the fact that there's some kind of physical stifling of movement on the part of black people, meaning if you have people who are working, making money, they have children, they have aspirations, and then you're sort of limited to the segregation and the power structure that's kind of strangling you. So in other words, you can't move mobility-wise beyond just the jobs or maybe the social aspect. You cannot move up. So what you're describing is, you know, we've heard similar stories, and it continues throughout the United States, especially living here in New York City where I am. But what I was saying was just trying to understand the fact that now you have white flight happening. White flight meant that they were just fleeing the physical presence of blacks. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Absolutely. So they're having the ability to actually engineer an economic increase, but they cannot have a political or a larger play in the structure of Detroit. So given that that's all the boiling pot, what exactly, you mentioned the blind pig raid. And
yes.
That was just, it almost sounds like when we talk here in New York, the LGBT group that points, I think it's the Stonewall riots. It was like a festive thing, and then it started, are we not taking it anymore? And it kind of blew up. But once this blew up, and the trauma of people who now are witnessing, as you said, the troops being sent in, and why did they send in troops with actual tanks? What was the reasoning? Because it wasn't stopping?
Because it wasn't
stopping.
Right.
Because it wasn't
exactly.
stopping.
And
we
stopped, witnessed, yeah.
we had that happen here too in New York, as you
probably
know.
Yeah, it wasn't stopping because basically they're just, you know, every Molotov cocktail that was thrown just fueled it a little bit more. You have John Conyers standing on the hood of a car trying to stop. You have Willie Horton, who was a hometown hero, our former Detroit Tiger, who literally finished a baseball game, concluded he didn't even take his uniform off. He got in his car and drove over to 12th and Claremont area and tried to quell the violence and the looting that was going on. And he was a hero at the time. So you had a lot of people trying to stop something that had started.
So that's what brought the was it the National Guard or the that had the armored truck? So what really
the
caused
National Guard.
The National Guard? The National Guard. So you know, there's so many angles to this, and I don't mean to cut your train of thought, Kimberly, but when we talk about history in terms of even an event like this, and there's that whole rebellion versus riots and perspective on how you view an event like this when it involves so much of America's biggest problem in not acknowledging racial issues that are longstanding. I would dare say, because you're a historian, so I don't really have a lot of reason to prompt you to tell the story. So I just want to ask you this. You mentioned your book or the book that you collaborated on, and that is that. You said it mentioned a little bit. That was mostly about the Underground Railroad. But I would like to offer this as a question and maybe a comment. I tend to read things also with, you know, with two eyes, you know, one as just an American citizen and then one with the black perspective. So I often wonder when I read the stories of the accounts of things, why we don't have more black writers, in other words, telling the story from the black perspective. So I want to ask if you would comment on your feelings or if there's any intention on your part or others that you may know of who may be writing to counter what may be, you know, the establishment perspective. Is there any thoughts on that or even any general commentary you may have about that?
Well, first I will say that we have we ourselves as a people are kind of, if you want to say, for lack of a better way to describe it, we're kind of in a hole. Our history is oral. Our history is not written. We are a people of storytellers, griots. The village griot held the stories, and as people would come and visit, or you wanted to find out some history of some particular event, that's what who you went to was to the village griot. So we've never historically written anything down. We're getting now, as we move forward in history, to telling our story, and we're telling it so that it can be repeated and studied and remembered by those other than the village. Unfortunately, part of that is instead of those that are writing are those that experienced it, it still tends to be third party. We are not writing our own stories. So anyone, if you're not, there's a African proverb that until the lion tells their own story, it'll always It'll always be the story of the hunter. We have got to learn to tell our own story, and we've never done that before. And we've also allowed ourselves to be led along by the hunter. So the hunter continues to not only tell our story outwardly, he's telling us our own story. When we even believe it. Okay, we're believing those that hunt us. So as a historian, as an author and as a researcher, I And as a speaker, because I do, I speak around the country, actually in several countries. I always try to get across in my whenever I'm talking, is to be sure that you are telling your own story. You tell your own story. You don't wait for someone else to tell your story. So this, the book that we wrote that was discussed or has been discussed, The Fluid Frontier, several times, involves the stories of families told by the family. In particular, my family, abolitionists to the core. As I said, I'm the daughter, the descended daughter of Freedom Seeker 4, actually. Carolyn Quarles Watkins and her husband, Alan Watkins, in particular, who ended here. Carolyn has quite a family history. She is the cousin. She was the great niece of a gentleman by the name of Roger Quarles, who was the father of John Mercer, Gideon, Charles, and Maria Langston. the Langstons are Charles Langston, as history would have it, ended up being the grandfather of Langston Hughes. So in my family tree, we are a people. Not only
we're going to tell the story.
Not only that runs in our veins, we tell our story. Charles Langston was tied to John Brown, as was John Mercer Langston, and of course Langston Hughes. When he writes, he tells the story of the family. That's what he's doing.
Beautiful.
He's telling our story.
What continuing
and
that
I
we want
to
tell
to jump in here,
sorry.
Kimberly. I'm sorry, I have to jump in here real quickly. You're talking about my favorite story right now. That is the John Price. And I think we should close on you telling that story, because you are a griot, and I want you to tell it from the point of view of our ancestors, from the griot type of presentation of the John Price story, and how it reflects what's going on today with all these shootings, and you know how they dealt with it. Your descendants who are abolitionists, and how you think they may have approached what's going on today. So I'm going to go back into mute mode and let you go. All righty.
We're going to go back into mute mode. The John Price story, it's tied to the Langston family. I am the, as I said, I'm John Price is tied inexplicably to the Langston story through Charles Langston. Charles Langston, my cousin, was the de facto head of what was called the Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society. He was Oberlin College houses not only many abolitionist stories, but it also houses or around surrounding campuses houses the John Mercer Langston National Historic Site, Charles's brother. I've been very privileged to stay in that house when I visited Oberlin at one point. But the Price story that Leslie so wonderfully speaks of was what is called historically the Wellington, Oberlin Wellington rescue. It was the rescue of a man by the name of John Price, who was held in bondage, as a matter of fact, held in bondage in Kentucky. And for those that have ever been to the Ripley home, to Ripley and been in the John Rankin home, you can see the field from across the Ohio River that John Price literally was working and was where he was held in bondage and worked. He could stand in the field on the Kentucky side of the river and see Reverend Rankin's house. I was there just a year ago, right before my wonderful friend Jerry Gore died, who was the griot in Ripley and Maysville, Kentucky. And he reminded me of the fact, and it took me quite a few minutes to regain my composure to know that I was standing at a spot that my cousins actually fought over. John Price was arrested. John Price was arrested, thrown in jail, and was rescued by the Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society, led by Charles Langston. There's so much tied, and I know we've got someone here muted, and I know this is her favorite story. There's so much tied to this story. It's so hard to flesh all of it out. John Price was eventually rescued and was sent across the Ohio River. However, his rescuers were jailed. Charles Langston was jailed, and at his trial, his speech was probably, it's still in the annals. You can Google Charles Langston's speech, The Wellington Rescue, and read it. But John Mercer Langston, Charles Langston, were tantamount in promoting the war of their friend. He called it a war. He did call it a war, not a rebellion, a war, and that was John Brown. They were two of his, if you want to say, lieutenants. They recruited their cousin, Lewis Sheridan Leary, who was one of five men that fought at Harper's Ferry with John Brown over the arsenal in West Virginia. That was the precursor to the Civil War. You know, there's so much there, Leslie, and I wish I could just spread out the Wellington Rescue, but if you tie that back to what's going on today, rebellion, that's the word. It's a rebellion against good, or what we feel is what should be going on, versus the powers that be. People arrested, people jailed because of who they are, people shot because of who they are, not what they did, who they are. Miriam, I know there's incidences that have happened in New York City. There's incidents that have happened all over the country. I just wonder what you think of the movement toward rebellion now, because Black Lives Matter, make no mistake about it, is the newest version of the civil rights movement. And it's come about at a time that it has to. There are so many events that are culminating here in this year of 50th commemoration.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say that in the essence of time, I'm just trying to collapse my thoughts. I realize that this is a big subject because it's a subject that keeps getting addressed in very piecemeal fashion. This commemorative 50th commemorative event of the 1967 rebellion is so important because it needs to be cataloged and shared, because I'm somebody who tries to keep my finger on the pulse of all things activists, etc. And I was saying, we knew of other cities, because I think there was over 150 cities who had similar, smaller skirmishes, bigger, larger, whatever, in 1967. 1967 was a hotbed year. Now we're talking cyclically, and in a cycle that is ultimately culminating again in this with the same element of rebellion, because there has not been any clarity or movement per se on the greater clock of race movement in terms of white supremacy. So I look at what you're saying and sharing today as so very, very important, especially because you are a witness, because you're so eloquent, you are a historian, you know where to position it. And my thought is that the movements around the city and around your city, I am Facebook friends with someone who is part of a movement to reclaim even the housing that has been neglected in Detroit. So when I was asked to do this, I was elated because I've been witnessing this woman does a lot of postings where she is live trying to chronicle. As a matter of fact, she's running for office locally in the council level, in the city level, to deal with some of the racism that is the underpinning for all of this. The riots only happen when there is disparity, when there is neglect, when there is abuse, and particularly at the hands of white supremacy, which comes in all forms, shapes, known and unknown, because the judge before you could be a white supremacist, the person, you know, that you trust, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of little parts to this, and we can't all cover it in this lovely hour that it looks like we have. But I would like to ask you, what are your final thoughts? It's more about you and your witnessing than myself. What are your final thoughts? What would you like listeners to come away from in terms of the whole trauma and the parallels and the shootings and things that are going on, that seemingly the administration seems to be just as blind or as non-caring as it was in 1967. In other words, what I mean specifically, with all the shootings and all the unfair events that we are now witnessing via video and via, you know, camera work, and then the perpetrators getting, you know, a slap on the hand, totally exonerated. So many what look like very guilty police are being, you know, exonerated in the court system. So what is going to happen, or do you think is going to happen in Detroit, where you're an expert, concerning the movement, even as you commemorate? How can people who listen in, how can they be supportive of moving that needle against white supremacy? What do you think, or any thoughts you may have on that? And then we're going to wrap up.
Well, I get back to my roots, which is history, the historical perspective. And I was asked by a 50-year-old transplanted Chicagoan who has now been living here in Detroit for 8 months. He's met and fell in love with one of our longtime Detroiters, and he's a motivational speaker. He does a lot of talks around town to young people, and in particular other transplanters. He's adopted Detroit as his home, and we had the opportunity to work on a project together a couple weeks ago and had an opportunity to talk for over the course of 4 or 5 hours. And he said to me that as he goes along and speaks to these young people, young new urbanites that are coming from other places that have not been Detroit born and bred, or maybe haven't been, let's just say, urban bred. These are suburbanites that are repopulating the urban areas. He says, what do I say to them when they say that Detroit, and I'll just say in general, this place is a blank slate? I told him, tell them they are not correct. There is no place like Detroit that is 316 years old. It is not a blank slate. The people that live here are not just here waiting for someone to come and tell them which way to walk, which way to talk, and to save them. And we, unfortunately, are living in a time where you have a group of people that do not understand that history, and it's been said and said and said, if you don't understand it, you are destined to repeat it until you do. And if you don't understand where you live, if you don't get involved with the people that are there, if you don't take a heart with their plight or what has happened to them, what has transpired in their life, if you don't take an active role in trying to understand them in the place that you're living, then you will repeat what happened 50 years ago. You will repeat the housing issues. You will repeat the discrimination. It gets repeated. As I said 50 years ago, we had a white mayor. 50 years later, we have a white mayor again. This is the first time we've had a white mayor in 40 years. The parallels are almost scary in Detroit at this point as we move forward toward, and other places. I bet you if you took apart Newark, you took apart other places that were having unrest at the same time, you'd find the same circumstances all over again. We have an administration in Washington that's a little different than the Washington, the administration that was there 50 years ago. However, it's an administration we are having to deal with, and unfortunately, it's not very friendly to cities with populations such as what we have here. But I would say to anyone that's listening, young people, older people, please, please, you need to listen to the griots, listen to the historians, because that is so important to understand where you come from moving forward. It really is. It's imperative. It's imperative.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing from you again, Kimberly. Such a wealth of information. I really, really am thankful that you're still here to be a griot and witness this. Peace and blessings to you. And
thank you so much, Mary. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.